Son. Est-ce que vous m'entendez dans la salle? Vous m'entendez? Alors tout va bien. Merci à vous d'être présent à cette conférence parce qu'on a le grand honneur et le grand plaisir de recevoir avec nous Glenn Cook qui a fait le voyage et c'est vraiment un immense plaisir car c'est un immense auteur. Pour vous brosser rapidement parce qu'on va avoir 1 heure pour discuter ensemble certains de ses titres hein, notamment La Compagnie Noire, Les Instrumentalités de la Nuit, Garrett Détective Privé, et puis il y a des choses qui n'ont pas encore été publiées en français comme la série Dread Empire ou Starfisher ou Dark War, désolé pour mon accent anglais, et on va essayer donc de parcourir un petit peu la carrière littéraire de Glenn Cook qui est véritablement riche. Mais ma première question, Glenn Cook, c'est quand est-ce que vous avez commencé à lire? Enfant, vous lisiez beaucoup?
Is this working? There it goes. Yes, I started reading at a very early age. I always and still do read a great, great, great deal. I have an iron rule in my life that I have to read 50 pages of something every day.
Ah, c'est une bonne règle, tout du moins. Quels sont les auteurs qui vous ont marqué à cet âge-là?
I started out reading what we call westerns in America by Luke Short, Louis L'Amour, and Zane Grey. Then I discovered science fiction, and I read everything that was in the public library that was available as science fiction. I had a very good librarian who would find books for me from throughout the library system in order to feed my addiction, just because she liked kids who actually read books.
J'ai entendu parler de Jack Vance, Fritz Leiber, qui vous aurait particulièrement marqué.
Later, yes, when I discovered fantasy, Fritz Leiber was very important to me. Jack Vance has been one of my favorites ever since I discovered him. Wish he would continue writing, but he's almost 100 now and been blind for the last 30 years, so it's very difficult for him to write. Of course, Tolkien. Everybody's read Tolkien. I reread The Lord of the Rings periodically. Many, many, many authors that I follow. I like the juvenile authors a great deal, Diana Wynne Jones and Tamora Pierce and several others whose books I read the instant that they come off the press.
C'était déjà de la fantaisie, c'était déjà de la science-fiction. Qu'est-ce qui vous plaisait à ce moment-là? C'était l'évasion de nouveaux mondes à découvrir?
Yes, I think so. I'm not really sure what all the appeal was. I was very much reading history, and as I say, the westerns before I discovered science fiction and fantasy, and continue still. But once I discovered science fiction, it opened whole new realms of wonder, I suppose. And it's been my main fiction reading all of my life.
Quand est-ce que vous avez commencé à écrire en parallèle? Comment c'est venu? Vous avez toujours écrit ou il y a un moment où vous vous êtes dit, j'ai envie d'imiter un petit peu ces auteurs-là?
I started trying to write stories when I was out of school, sick for a period of nearly a month, when I was 11 years old, I believe. I had all of the diseases in serial that we now inoculate our children against. Everything you can imagine, including scarlet fever and whooping cough, and the mom said I had them all one right after the other. And I started trying to write stories then, and did write an American Civil War story called The Hawk, which was not really a story. It was just a vignette of an encounter between Confederate and Union troops from the viewpoint of a hawk that was circling overhead. And I wrote a science fiction story that had to do something with Ramses II of Egypt fighting either the Hyksos or the Hittites at the time. Is anybody translating for the folks out here? Or do they all...
Oui, il y a quelqu'un qui traduit pour le public.
Oh, okay, good. Good. I don't remember anything much else about that story except that it was involved flying saucers during a chariot battle. From then on, all through my high school years, I wrote stories for the school literary magazine. And then when I went into the Navy, I was much too busy to do any writing. Then the Navy sent me to college. And during college, I discovered that I could fake my way through a lot of classes by writing stories about whatever the thing I was supposed to do, a report or a paper on. If I just made up a good fiction story about it, I could get a much better grade than, because for some reason the instructors were impressed with the fact that I would go to that effort when it was actually a whole lot easier for me. Then I went to work for General Motors and had no time to write until I was installed in a job where we were working at an ammunition plant during the Vietnam War, and we were there 7 days a week, 11 and a half hours a day, no days off, for almost 3 years. Good money. But the job they assigned me to consisted of sitting and waiting for the phone to ring, which it might do 3 times a week. And I would answer the deal with the problem. And the rest of the time I was sitting there reading books because I had nothing else to do. And I got to the point where I was reading books that were so bad that I said, I know I can do better than this. And since I had my own typewriter and company paper and everything else there to work with, I said, why don't I do it on their time? I did. It took me about 3 years to sell something. It was a lot harder than I thought it was. And I sold a couple of short pieces, and I sold a couple of short novels. And then for 9 more years, I couldn't give away anything. But I kept writing all that time. And then during the 1980s, everything that I wrote during the 1970s all sold in a rapid amount of time. It looked like I was writing about a book a month rather than what I was actually doing.
On va revenir sur ses débuts. Je crois que les tout débuts de vos débuts d'écrivain professionnel datent de 1970. Comment ça s'est fait? Vous avez rencontré des éditeurs, vous leur envoyez des manuscrits, vous les avez tannés pour être publiés. Comment les rencontres, comment les choses se sont déroulées?
I had a great deal of luck getting started. I was single, and because I was working this job that I worked 7 days a week, 11 and a half hours a day, I did not have any social life, did not have any life but going to work and going home. But once I decided I wanted to be a writer, I came across a very small ad in the back of a science fiction magazine mentioning a writer's workshop. And mentioning the names of some of the people that were going to be there that were fairly substantial names at the time: Harlan Ellison, Damon Knight, Fritz Leiber, and Frederick Pohl, and a few others. And I said, well, I'll never get into this, but I'll apply, because if I don't apply, I, you know, never, I'll be sorry the rest of my life that I didn't at least try. So I sent in an application, and much to my surprise, I was accepted. And while I was there, not only did I meet the six or seven well-known authors who were instructors there and get a lot of encouragement from them because they seemed to see something worthwhile in my efforts, I also met a number of editors and other people who came to the workshop from New York City to explain how the publishing business worked. And those people looked at my stuff that I was doing there, and one suggested that if I took a story that I had and expanded it into a novel, that he would show it to his boss. Well, I was excited. I did that. He showed it to his boss. She called me on the phone and told me if I would rewrite it a certain way, she would buy it. And so in December of 1972, my first published science fiction novel titled The Heirs of Babylon appeared from Signet Books. And then I had a great deal of adventures with the next book, which was entitled The Shadow of All Night Falling. I wrote it, I submitted it. I forget which publisher it was right now, but they accepted it. Oh, it was Lancer Books. They accepted it and promptly went into bankruptcy and returned all properties. So I submitted it again, and it was accepted by a company called Dell Books, who promptly had a major fire in their production facility and ceased publication of all stuff except their absolute bestseller items, because they could get those done under contract by another printer. So it was returned to me again. And in 1979, I finally had it, saw it published by Berkeley Books, where it received a great deal of critical acclaim and nobody bought it, which has been a problem with a lot of my books over the years. The critics like them. They're completely different, they say, from much else that was being published in English at the time. And very few people buy them at the retail level. However, as time has gone by, almost all of my stuff has remained in print. So even though it doesn't sell a lot on any given day, it sells a lot over time.
Oui, ça ne vous a jamais découragé? C'est-à-dire que l'activité d'écrivain était plus forte que toutes ces mésaventures. Vous aviez envie d'écrire?
Yes, I am. I guess compelled. I have a psychological compulsion to do it. It's entirely irrelevant to me whether the thing actually gets published. I'm happy when it does. I walk into the bookstore now with, I believe, my 49th or 50th book. It just appeared in French. Published early for this downstairs, and I walk in there and look at that with the same amount of excitement that I did at the very first one. Very thrilled. Every time somebody is foolish enough to buy one of my books and invest money in publishing it, I just am thrilled right down to my toenails. I lost my point.
Vous nous racontiez que vous lisiez de la science-fiction et de la fantasy, et quand vous êtes mis à écrire, c'était déjà de la science-fiction et de la fantasy. Est-ce que ça s'est fait normal, ou est-ce que le genre vous a donné une liberté supplémentaire par rapport à du polar ou du roman historique? Pourquoi est-ce que vous avez plutôt choisi ces genres science-fiction et fantasy?
I think I chose it at first because it was what I knew best. It was what I was reading most, and there were things out there that I really wanted to write stuff like. I mean, almost all writers seem to start out trying to write the same thing as their favorite authors. So the first few things I wrote were very heavily influenced by Jack Vance, by Fritz Leiber, and by somewhat obscure English writer named Edison. He had a couple of initials in front, but I'm not really sure what they were now. But he was a difficult read because he assumed that you had an English public school education, and so he would break out into classical Greek or Latin or whatever and just assume you knew what he was talking about because you had the same education as him. And part of the challenge with him, besides the ornate language, which I loved, was looking up sources and whatnot, trying to find out what he was saying to me in Greek or so forth. So, yes, I started out very much trying to imitate people, and very little of that material ever got published until I began to find, I guess, my own voice. And I think that's pretty much true for most writers. Unless they are born with their own voice very strongly, they start out trying to be just like someone else.
Parlons un petit peu de La Compagnie Noire, un de vos cycles les plus connus, si ce n'est le plus connu. Quelle était un petit peu l'idée d'origine? Comment vous avez imaginé cette histoire au départ?
When I first started, I was going to write one book told from the viewpoint of the ordinary soldiers who worked for somebody like Sauron of Mordor. What was their everyday life like? What did they think of their boss? I mean, you're a private soldier working for the great evil of the world. Do you even think about that? Do you even care about it? And that was my starting point, and I tried to write about men who were rather like the rotiers that the English left in France here. I don't know, it's called the Hundred Years' War over on the English or English language side. I don't know what it's called in France, but it's a 123 years long or something like that, and it terminated shortly after Joan of Arc showed up. I was trying to write about people who were rather like those people who were abandoned and had to make a life the only way they knew how, which was kill people and burn things. I submitted the book, and it was, for reasons I've never understood, not given to the fantasy editor at the publisher, but the horror editor. And although she was the horror editor, she thought it was too dark and too bleak, and she didn't like any of the characters. And so she rejected it. But then I got a phone call from her about 4 weeks later saying, I can't get these people out of my head. I can't get this story out of my head. I'm going to change my mind. I'm going to publish this. But you have to get together with me somewhere and we'll talk about what changes need to be made. Well, as it happened, there was a world fantasy convention not far from where I lived coming up shortly, and she was going to be there. Her husband is the man who later became known as Robert Jordan, although he was not Robert Jordan at the time. So we met there and got drunk and got rowdy and talked and talked and talked for hours and hours and hours, and decided that I could write the kind of characters I wanted in the kind of situations I wanted if I could produce a trilogy and a long story arc that would make them, make my people actually rather heroic, even though they were not heroic characters. They did have that aspect to their being that they could see light and darkness and good and evil and whatnot. And in very small ways, do the right thing or do good things, even though they were in service to something not so good. So we agreed to do that. I wrote the three books, and by the time I finished the third book, I knew what the whole fourth book was going to be. The fourth book became so long that it got split into two books, and then by then I knew the fifth and the sixth books. And the sixth book suddenly grew up until it was four very fat books, which overall are under the story arc Glittering Stone. Then at that point I stopped doing the books. I had pretty well used up everything I had in mind, but at this point I have two more that I'm going to do. One of them is already partially written, and pieces of it have appeared in American anthologies, the first two chapters, as separate stories. Its title will be Port of Shadows, and it will occur between the first and second books of The Black Company, which are separated by 5 years in time. It will be right in the middle of time between those two. And the last will be A Pitiless Rain. I don't know if that'll even translate. And it will be set after the last book that has been published so far and will involve the children and whatnot and the god Croaker.
Est-ce que quel regard vous portez sur cette série qui vous a accompagné pendant de nombreuses années? Est-ce que c'est votre série la plus marquante? En même temps, je pense que Garrett est aussi très important. Comment est-ce que vous voyez cette série de la Compagnie Noire?
I don't think it's particularly striking or anything. It's just picking up more stories of the particular characters that I know as well as anyone I know in my family or anything. There's people that I've, many of them in fact in the early books are based upon people that I served with in the military and have their attitudes towards life and talk the way they do and behave the way they would have if they were in such dire circumstances, or at least the way I believe they would have. It's not the compulsion that I have to continue it is simply to continue being with my characters, with my people. It's the only way I can be with them is to be their god, so to speak, and try to move them around the chessboard, which they always refuse to do the way I want to do, because they are real enough people that they do things the way they want to do them. And we have fights, me and my imaginary people. We have fights about whether we're going to do things and how we're going to do things.
Est-ce que parfois ils ont fait des choses que vous n'aviez pas envie qu'ils fassent ou ils vous ont surpris eux-mêmes?
Oh yes, very much so. Actually, more so in my Garrett series than in the Black Company, because in the Garrett series there are a lot of characters that I don't know as well as I do the characters in the Black Company. And while working with the Black Company people, I know them well enough to know before I ever try to force them into a wrong role that they won't go there, so I don't do it in the first place. In the Garrett series, very often I will get big surprises from characters because I think I can make them do something that might be amusing or something. And they say, no way, that's not funny. You're not going to do that to me.
Parlez-vous justement de Garrett, comment, même question un petit peu, comment est née cette idée de cette série avec ce détective et puis son ami l'elfe? Une série de polar et avec du fantastique dedans pour ceux qui ne le connaîtraient pas.
That's correct. It's basically what's called the American Private Eye novel, but set in a setting where you have all of the claptrap of cutesy fantasy and whatnot underfoot. You have elves and dwarves and vampires and zombies and everything else. They're there and always in the way. It's kind of bears some resemblance to Hank Mortpork in the Discworld, except that there's no cross influence that I know of. I started writing the Garretts before I ever ran into Terry Pratchett. It started, the initial book, Sweet Silver Blues, was written as a straight detective novel about 1980, and my agent said, I can sell this, but you won't get very much money for it, because at that time there was not much of that sort of fiction being published. He says, I'd just as soon not get you debranded and get you into an area where you're not well known. And so I put it aside, and then about 2 years later suddenly realized that I could set this in a fantasy setting and have a great deal of fun with it. And I, because of my compulsion to do certain things and writing and whatnot, I could not, once I thought that, not do it. So I got the book out and I plugged in some vampires and whatnot. Got some real surprises. I had my character just freshly getting beaten up by some bad guys, and he completely out of the blue told me, it's time to go to see the dead man. Well, I had no idea who the dead man was until my character actually said, it's time to go see him. Then I had to figure out who he was. And he's been a critical key character throughout the 13 or 14 books now. He's a character who is literally dead. He's been dead for 450 years, but he won't quit. He stays in his body and communicates telepathically and is kind of a supercomputer for Garrett. Garrett reports to him and gets people to report to him, and the dead man has multiple minds that he uses to process the information and find connections that are not obvious to normal people. A lot of the books are pretty silly, and early on a lot of them are pastiches of some of my own favorite detective writers. One of them is a kind of Lovecraftian pastiche. All the Lovecraftian gods are running around the Tunfair causing civil distress and whatnot, and this Garrett's ends up being the one who has to solve the problem. Is that pretty well?
On a l'impression, à vous écouter, à vous lire, ce sont des romans à la fois parfois un peu durs, mais surtout, il y a une bonne dose d'humour noir. Il y a certains auteurs pour qui l'écriture est difficile, mais à vous entendre, on a vraiment l'impression que c'est un plaisir et c'est un amusement. C'est vraiment ça?
Oh yeah, that's a big, big, big part of the fun that I'm having. I don't see my work as dark. That's something that people say that it is, that tell me that it is, but I think it's just ordinary, everyday life sort of stuff. If you happen to be in that situation, of course. I mean, none of us none of us are in a situation where the only way we can make a living is to bust things and break people's bones and whatnot. So, trying to find the right way to say, I don't think that this stuff is dark, but I can't think of anybody that I off the top of my head that I would consider dark. So to provide an example of the difference, but I'm just having fun, and when I plug in humor and gallows humor and stuff, it's just a lot of it is the same thing I saw when I was in the military, and the way that other military people have reported to me that stuff that they have seen. My work, especially the Black Company, is extremely popular with American servicemen, and I get a lot of feedback. Almost everybody I meet that has served in Iraq or Afghanistan read my books while they were there and have anecdotes that they want to give me that maybe I can use someday that they think were absolutely hilarious gallows humor kind of things that happened in their experience. And so I am building up quite a library of really bizarre incidents that I will be able to use at some point or other.
Alors, justement, comment est-ce que vous travaillez? Est-ce que on le voit, vous vous servez aussi des anecdotes qu'on vous raconte, mais est-ce que parfois, quand je crois que vous lisez beaucoup, et notamment vous êtes passionné d'histoire, est-ce que parfois vous dites tiens, il y a cet élément-là, il irait bien dans cette histoire-là, ou alors tiens, cet élément-là, ça ferait un bon début de scénario?
Oh, I do that all the time. The series that I'm producing right now, The Instrumentalities of the Night, reflects a lot of incidents from medieval history, not in any one-for-one comparison or anything, not like taking a particular battle and just replaying it, but taking an incident from a campaign that I find particularly intriguing. For instance, the Third Crusade. All of the great kings of Europe were going to the Holy Lands to liberate the Holy Lands. And there was no way that the Muslims could have survived this if they'd all got there, because there were literally hundreds of thousands of Christians going there to liberate the Holy Land. Well, eventually, only the kings of England and France actually made it, and the king of France got mad at the king of England and went home, and the emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor, coming with something like 120,000 men, coming overland through Turkey, fell off his horse and drowned. So those 120,000 men, almost all of them just turned around and went home. So that was a severe advantage to the local peoples, since they only had to deal with Richard the Lionheart, rather than the entire male population of Europe.
Je crois qu'il y a une bataille aussi à Poitiers qui vous a particulièrement intéressé.
Yes, that one's shown up in a couple of different books. Several of the battles, actually, of the Hundred Years' War. Crécy, I don't know how to pronounce that properly, but yeah, Agincourt. Several of the battles where the English came off very well, even though they lost the war, have turned up, at least in some part, in several of my series. I think I've used most of the significant battles of the Hundred Years' War in the Dread Empire series at some point or other. That's not available in French, so I don't think that it is. I'm not aware of it if it is. And in some other books, I have used a lot of incident. Never, as I say, though, it's never one-on-one. It's not line up the guys on each side and just change the names of the kings and have the same things happen.
Et pourquoi pas particulièrement cette guerre de 100 ans? Parce qu'elle a été particulièrement longue, avec beaucoup de rebondissements, ou c'est dû à la période?
Well, the Hundred Years' War was not a continuous war. There'd be, I think it's probably considered one war because it was, even though it lasted over a century, it was always about the same thing, about who was going to be the King of France. And the King of England seemed to think that he had the job and that the guy in France was a pretender, and the guy in France seemed to think that King of England had no real claim on it, however he was related and however the properties had been handed down and whatnot from generation to generation. And it's just really fascinating to watch the tides swirl this way and swirl that way. And the whole thing being influenced a great deal by stuff outside the actual conflict, the politics of the time, who's pushing who to do what, just how much money one king or the other could raise in order to finance a campaign, often influenced the way the tides of war went. The French king almost always had the advantage monetarily, but usually if they met the English in a set piece battle, it always came off badly for the French. And often there's no figuring out why, except that some particular duke or baron or whatever would decide that this is a good time not to show up, or this is a good time to make my point, you know, by not participating. I'll just sit here and watch while you get your butt kicked. So the whole thing is, you know, it's history that pretty much the way it is throughout the world, but it's history that's very much more accessible to me as a person of European descent and of English descent and whatnot. I can understand it probably better than similar things in China or India. The same things happen, the same kind of problems are dealt with, but it's a little bit more understandable.
Quand on lit votre bibliographie, il y a des périodes où sont publiés quasiment 3 romans par an, quasiment. Aujourd'hui, il y en a un petit peu moins. Est-ce que ça veut dire que votre manière de travailler a changé, ou que c'est plus compliqué aujourd'hui ou plus long pour vous d'écrire un livre?
There's a couple of things of work. During the 1980s, yes, I was having 3 books a year come out. But that was because, as I mentioned much earlier, that I was writing all through the 1970s and not publishing anything. And, excuse me. All of the stuff that I wrote during the 1970s at the rate of a book about every 6 or 8 months was getting published during the 1980s. There was a month, May, I believe it is, of 1985, when I had 3 books come out from 3 different publishers, none of which were written in the 1980s. All of them had been written in the 1970s. Also, the books in those days were compelled to be shorter. You could only write, it was partly a mechanical thing. The presses used by the printers could only publish or could only print books that were so thick. There was a limit on the thickness and whatnot of a book, so you were limited at the length that you could write. Further, these days, we writers work on computers instead of a typewriter. When you work on a typewriter and you have to retype every draft, you tend to be much more of a spare writer the first time through and try to get it right because you don't want to take a couple months to type it up again in a clean copy. With a computer, you can just kind of loaf and let it go as long as you want. And for me, even though I generally cut out probably 40% of what I write before I turn in a manuscript, the books now are twice as long as they were back in the day, simply because it's easier to do that. I noticed a number of my books, when they're published in French, they split them into two because the English version is so long. I'm amongst the people who write the shorter books now in American fantasy, so there may be people you'll never see here, like Steven Erickson, whose books are like that thick, and there's 10 volumes that thick in his series.
Il nous reste un petit quart d'heure. Est-ce que quelqu'un a une question à poser à Glenn Cook ou est-ce qu'on continue cette interview? Allez-y, n'hésitez pas, c'est le bon moment. Petite question, une fois. Oui, monsieur, là-bas.
J'aimerais savoir si, notamment la Compagnie Noire, le fait que le Trône de Fer soit sorti en série maintenant, est-ce que ça pourrait être une possibilité pour la Compagnie Noire ou est-ce que ça ne vous intéresse pas? Enfin, qu'est-ce que vous en pensez, quoi?
If I understand the question, is it, will there be a cinema version of Black Company? My agent is in negotiation right now with, and this means absolutely nothing because we've been in negotiations with somebody about something of my writing continuously with Hollywood over years and years and nothing ever comes of it. But we're in negotiation right now with one of the producers who was involved in the Indiana Jones and the prequel trilogy of Star Wars to do a Black Company thing, but they haven't decided whether they want to do it as a feature film series or as a television series like the Game of Thrones. Whether anything will come of that, your guess is probably better than mine. Does that answer your question? Good.
Est-ce que quelqu'un a une autre question à poser à Glenn Cook? Profitons-en. Enfin. Alors, simplement, on va continuer. Il y a un certain nombre de séries qu'on ne connaît pas encore en France. Est-ce que vous pourriez nous dire un petit mot, notamment de Dread Empire et de Starfisher? Qu'est-ce que ça, de quoi parlent ces séries?
The Dread Empire is a fantasy series that was originally conceived to be 14 volumes, three of which would be consist of short stories. It's actually conceived of as being one extremely long novel involving certain key characters and their entire lifetime from the time that they are young men forced to flee. Each one comes from a totally different culture, but circumstances force them to flee their home. And they meet and become friends, and two of the three grow up to become kings, and the other one dies young. It's a very, very complex history of a world where magic works, of course. I mean, it's fantasy. So, it's almost, it's very difficult for me to explain beyond that level, except that it's a world that, in addition to the characters who are interacting and then empires and nations and tribes, kingdoms that are in conflict and swirling conflict, sides changing, alliances shifting and whatnot, there is an over character variously called the Star Rider or the Director or whatnot, who's stirring it all up. And he's doing it for reasons that are intentionally obscure, but if you pay attention, you will eventually figure it out. Part of the, this is a critically very well received sort of thing, but it was not commercially popular because it required the reader to do so much work, so much of the work. If you failed to read the chapter heading, the chapter title, and did not internalize it, you would get lost. Every single little point and incident and whatnot in the Dread Empire series as originally conceived was important. Even the names of the characters, you had to go, if you really wanted to know something more about them, you had to go to Old English or Old French or something or other and find out what that word meant in the year 800 or thereabouts. So those have just been brought back into print in English by a company called Nightshade Books. And seven of them were published. Nightshade has published now one of the story collections. And in January, they will be publishing a novel, A Path to Coldness of Heart, which basically wraps up the series at 8 volumes rather than the projected amount. It's got the incidents and whatnot from the what would have been the next 4 books compressed into one. Part of the problem with that was, I guess, tell an anecdote. When I first began to be published regularly, I got invited to a lot of science fiction, fantasy fan things in my part of the world. My wife and I started having annual parties at our house for friends that we had made by attending those events, and they got quite huge. It got to be 120, 150 people come to the house for the weekend. And one year, the last year that we had it, someone got into my private files. They stole some of the key books, almost 35 or 40 key books out of my book collection disappeared, including some rather rare ones. The only copy that I had of a porno novel that I wrote, which was the first thing that I ever got paid for, disappeared. And all of the developmental material for the next book of the Dread Empire, except for one carbon copy of page 143 of the next book, was stolen. Now, how people got all this stuff out of my house without anyone noticing, I have no idea. But when I came back to the Dread Empire 20 years after the fact, or 15 years, however long it was, to write the book for Nightshade that would wrap it up, I had nothing but my memories to go on because all of the material that went with it had been stolen by someone who really wanted to know what was going to happen next. End of anecdote.
Il y a, votre carrière a commencé, on l'a dit, il y a 30 ans. Quel regard portez-vous dessus sur ces 30 ans? Est-ce que le jeune homme qui a publié une première fois en 1970 a eu la vie qu'il voulait?
Yeah, I've had a good life. I've been very lucky throughout my life. I'm happy. I'm a small fish or a medium-sized fish in a small pond at home. My books sell after 30 years, 35 years. My books began to sell well enough so that I can actually do it for a living. Most of my life, I worked for General Motors in various capacities until I was offered an opportunity to take an early retirement during the middle of the 1990s. I've not been hugely famous or hugely commercially successful like a Stephen King or anything, but I'm totally happy with my life. I've got a wonderful wife that I've had for ever. Absolutely wonderful woman. Give you the shirt off her back, and I have three marvelous sons, all of whom have advanced the bloodline dramatically. Nobody in my time or before me ever graduated from college, but all three of mine are not only college graduates but masters, and the oldest one is a major in the United States Army. The second one is an architect who works on sports stadiums and hospitals and that sort of thing. And my youngest one is a symphony musician who plays flute in symphonic orchestras.
On a le temps, on a 5 minutes pour une dernière question. Monsieur là-bas. Oui, il y avait un monsieur là-bas qui devait la main, s'il peut relever la main.
Bonjour. J'ai remarqué au fil des lectures de vos livres que de nombreux personnages assez de premier plan mouraient au fil des aventures. Et je voulais savoir s'il y avait une volonté derrière ça, par exemple d'afficher un collectif ou de montrer les enjeux des puissances plutôt que des personnages, ou la volonté de justement ne pas rentrer dans les codes du héros classique qui vint toujours à la fin, etc. Merci.
Pretty much true, yes. The hero or the protagonist, whatever, of the Black Company series is the company. It's not the people who are in it. There are people who go on, last through number of books. Sometimes they die and sometimes they come back to life. Croker is a central character throughout the series. It always was, always will be. He will appear in the books yet to come. But he is not the protagonist per se. The whole thing is about the company and the idea of the company, the thing that is bigger than the sum of its parts, if that answers your question.
Il y avait une autre question devant pour monsieur.
Bonjour, excusez-moi. Donc, à travers la Compagnie Noire, c'est un univers médiéval fantastique, très prononcé sur médiéval, et puis il y a un moment, il y a un intermède, si on va dire, sur la plaine de la peur, qui tient plus du merveilleux, avec des pierres qui parlent, des baleines qui volent. Qu'est-ce que c'est que cette plaine de la peur? C'est une fantaisie au milieu de la fantaisie?
Yeah, it is. Part of what I did when I made that deal to create an initial trilogy, according to that editor's blueprint was to cannibalize a big part of a book that I had partially written and given up on. And all of the stuff that happens, not all of the stuff, but most of the stuff that happens in that desert with the walking, talking stones and the wind whales and an old father tree and so on, was all cannibalized from another book that I had given up on. Now, it's writer laziness, but it also, I thought it worked quite well, and it illuminated certain characters and whatnot, brought certain interesting characters to light, like Toad Killer Dog. So, even with the Black Company, I have some fun making stuff up and being as weird as I can.
Allez, on prend une dernière peut-être question. Est-ce qu'il y en a une? Oui, madame, là-bas. Et puis après, on va laisser la place à la conférence qui suit. Elle est là-bas.
Merci. Bonjour. En fait, au fil du temps, le chroniqueur change et le ton change, la manière, peut-être les détails auxquels ils vont s'intéresser changent. Comment vous avez appréhendé le fait de vous faufiler dans une personnalité différente en fonction des chroniqueurs? Analyste, on me dit.
That's correct. That's deliberate, intentionally done. I wanted to show that history is almost never actually what's written down. When you change analysts, you see that not only is the tone different, but each new analyst generally tends to report where the previous analyst lied to you and made themselves look better and so on, which is what people do. It was all deliberate. And then how I got into the personalities enough to make it obvious that the changes were different and whatnot, I'm not absolutely sure. I guess that if I have a talent or a genius or something or other, maybe that was it.
Voilà. On va remercier Glenn Cook parce que l'heure est passée vite, mais elle est désormais terminée. Vous allez pouvoir le retrouver en dédicace. Et puis, si vous restez ici, il y a une conférence quand l'image de la science conduit à la science-fiction. Merci à vous et merci à Glenn Cook.